It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Sarah, welcome to you.
Welcome.
And Dennis Goldford in our Des Moines studio, Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Dennis, good to have you on board today.
Hi, Ben.
Later in the hour, we want to talk about J.D. Scholten's challenge to Steve King in Iowa's 4th District. Once again, he announced that this week. Of course, there's a primary going on to challenge Steve King as well. So it'll be a very interesting race to get commentary on, analysis from Sarah and Dennis about. Also, we want to talk about the escalating trade war with China, as that certainly does impact our farming community here in the Midwest and Iowa. But first of all, the top news of the day stemming from the weekend mass shootings. Let's talk about the president traveling to Dayton, then to El Paso. I'm reading the New York Times as we speak, Dennis and Sarah, that the president greeted at the airport. This is in Dayton, his motorcade passing two recreational vehicles adorned with pro-Trump signs and flags. But then also protesters gathering in Dayton to greet the president, waving signs that said "Dump Trump and do something." We heard a little bit of that in our top of the hour's newscast. So we have each of the camps represented there in Dayton. Let's listen to the president on Monday addressing the nation at a White House press conference in the aftermath of the mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. The president calling for what he said are real bipartisan solutions.
In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. These sinister ideologies must be defeated. Hate has no place in America. Hatred warps the mind, ravages the heart, and devours the soul. In the two decades since Columbine, our nation has watched with rising horror and dread as one mass shooting has followed another, over and over again, decade after decade. We must seek real bipartisan solutions. We have to do that in a bipartisan manner that will truly make America safer and better for all.
The president visiting those grieving communities last weekend's mass shootings, killing 31 people. This against a backdrop where some blame the president for inflaming racial divisions. Here's Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke calling President Trump a racist, said his words can be connected to Saturday's mass shooting in El Paso that left at least 20 dead and more than two dozen injured.
We've had a rise in hate crimes every single one of the last 3 years. During an administration where you have a president who's called Mexicans rapists and criminals, though Mexican immigrants commit crimes at a far lower rate than those born here in the country, he has tried to make us afraid of them to some real effect and consequence. Attempting to ban all Muslims from this country, the day that he signed that executive order, the mosque in Victoria, Texas, was burned to the ground. Those chants that we heard in Greenville, North Carolina, "Send her back," talking about our fellow American citizens duly elected to represent their constituents in the Congress who happen to be women of color. He is a racist, and he stokes racism in this country, and it does not just offend our sensibilities. It fundamentally changes the character of this country, and it leads to violence. And again, there are still details that we are waiting on, but I'm just following the lead that I've heard from the El Paso Police Department, where they say there are strong indications that this shooter wrote that manifesto and that this was inspired by his hatred of people here in this community.
Indeed, the four-page manifesto that the authorities say was written by the suspect in the El Paso shooting cited, quote, "a great replacement theory and a fear that white people will be replaced by people of color." We're going to reach out to our listeners briefly before going to our analysts. We want to, you listening, what are your thoughts as you observe the reactions of the president, other officials to the weekend mass shootings? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. So many facets to cover here. What's top of mind for you, Dennis, as we launch into this the ripples from these horrific shootings?
I guess I have
a feeling of tremendous sadness. I mean, I'm someone who is a political scientist by vocation, and my avocation has always been politics. But we're in a situation now, and I've been saying this in a perhaps discouraging way at the end of speeches, really going back almost 10 years now, that, you know, in politics, you have to see the other side as not your enemy, but your opponent. Jack Kemp famously once noted that, saying with regard to Democrats at a Republican rally in 1996. He said, the Democrats are our opponents. They're not our enemies. We're all Americans. And I think the social media, the internet generally, and the temper of the country over the past 20 or 25 years or so have eroded that sense that we're all Americans. And increasingly, people see the other side as enemies. There was a T-shirt I saw recently without somebody's face. Somebody was wearing it. It was just simply that sort of chest shot. It said, I'd rather be a Russian than a Democrat. And that sort of thing is appalling. And we have this exacerbation of these tensions, these differences people have. And it creates this climate in which some people, for their own particular reasons, whether political or psychological or emotional or whatever, are more prone to doing things like what we saw over the weekend. So it just saddens me tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Mitchell, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think we need to be concerned about the increasing pace with which mass shootings are occurring. So if you look at the data, the number of mass shootings that occurred in 8 years of Obama's presidency were approaching the frequency and casualties of those shootings today in terms of President Trump's cycle.
In so, just over 2 years.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the number of mass shootings is rapidly increasing. I do think some of the language that's been used by the killers in these cases is certainly, it's first of all, it's being inspired by online discussions and rhetoric. The shooter in Texas was inspired by the Christchurch killing in New Zealand. So some of the language of white replacement is similar to the manifesto that was written by the New Zealand shooter. You also see the language in the Texas shooters saying Hispanic invasion of Texas. The word invasion was also used by Trump at one of his events. So I think you're seeing not only online inspiration for some of these movements, but also the president does take responsibility for the language that he's using when he's addressing the nation.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what did you see in his Monday his Monday White House address in this? It was, we've known we have two different presidents. We have the teleprompter president and the rally president. This was definitely the teleprompter president, right?
Yes, I've often seen that recently as teleprompter Trump versus Twitter Trump. But yes, you see that difference. I mean, the president was clearly reading language that somebody wrote for him at the teleprompter there. And the words themselves are something that almost everybody, I think, would agree with. The question is, when he shows up for a rally or does Twitter, does he stay with that or does he go back to the kinds of language he has indeed been using? It's you know, we have this old phrase of my honorable opponent, but when what you do politically is attempt to demean, denigrate, and humiliate your opponent, that's disrespectful not just to your opponent, but to your audience. And the question again is who will prevail, teleprompter Trump or Twitter Trump? And in the past, it's Twitter Trump that's prevailed.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation, Dennis Goldford, Sarah Mitchell, political scientists. Dennis from Drake University, Sarah from the University of Iowa, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Chris is our first caller from Des Moines. Hi, Chris. Weigh in on this.
Hi. Yes. The like I was telling the guy that answered, we have to set blame where blame is. This president has stroked the bigotry and racism throughout the country. His base is bigotry. the folks that are foreign, their bigots like he is. And so until other white folks are going to have to start fighting the bigotry that this president is doing, as long as folks keep standing on the sideline and acting like it's okay for this president to keep doing what he's doing and acting how he's acting, this bigotry and racism and discrimination is going to continue on. It's not going to stop, and he's not going to stop. All that mess he talked the other day, that's just talking.
Right. Chris, he did condemn white nationalism and actions of this kind. That's what we expect from the president, and that's what he did.
Right, but he's the president that's supposed to be for everybody. So you can't tell me that he's for everybody when he's calling people of color pretty much out of their name and everything. So he's not for everybody. And folks, other white folks have to start calling him out, and not just him. We have to start calling out our senators, Grassley, Ernst. I know I've called them and told them that if they don't start saying something, that they're just going to stand on the sideline, and they agree with this president. So that makes them a bigot just like him.
Chris, in Des Moines, thank you very much for that call. 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk a little bit about if, and this is Dennis and Sarah, we've been through years of this, if this is the action that spurs some kind of gun regulation. Also, we have this state-level regulation that may be spurred by this. Yesterday, Ohio Governor Mark DeWine announced a series of legislative reforms to address gun violence and outlined some further action to increase mental health prevention, identification, and treatment to better protect Ohioans. Let's listen to the Ohio governor.
We must do something. And that is exactly what we are going to do. I'm asking the General Assembly to pass a law that requires background checks for all firearm sales in the state of Ohio, with the exception for gifts between family members and certain other limited uses. When a person possesses a firearm they know was fraudulently obtained, that person should be punished in the same manner as the person who bought the firearm, an F2, 2 to 8 years. We have to empower people to get help for family or loved ones who may be a danger to themselves or a danger to others. People who have mental health challenges, alcohol or drug problems, have violent tendencies, and have access to firearms. Deadly combination.
Ohio Governor Mark DeWine. Now, in his response on Monday, I just mentioned this to these shootings in El Paso and Dayton, the president called for an expansion of state laws that temporarily prevent someone in crisis from buying or possessing a gun. Your thoughts on whether this will spur at a state level, at a federal level, anything, Sarah?
Well, I think we've seen an increase in these red flag laws across, I think there's 20-some states now that have some version of these laws that basically provide law enforcement with the ability to identify extreme threats and to respond to them. And Senator Grassley is in favor of this approach as well. But I think, you know, we have to get at the root cause. So gun control addresses the ease with which people can get guns. It lowers the cost of mass shootings if you have easy access to guns. You know, we have 1.2 guns for every person in the United States. So clearly we have a serious, you know, supply problem in terms of guns in this country. But in terms of what is causing people to engage in mass shootings, I think some of the solutions beyond gun control need to address some of these root causes. So if we think about, for example, that over half of the mass shooters since 2017 had some background of domestic violence, for example. Mm-hmm. So we can think about gender issues as being related to gender security issues as being related to gun control. Or we could think about mental health has been an issue that's come up. But yet only about 1 in 5 mass shooters have a documented mental health problem. And so dealing with mental health issues is a good idea, but it's not going to get, like I said, at the root problem of why people are engaging in these mass shooting
incidents. Dennis, what are your thoughts on whether gun control bills are gaining ground also among Republicans? Or is that just something that we have for a few days and then it quiets down and fades away?
I think that is something that quiets down and fades away. At least that's been our history up till now. I mean, we have to remember that the American political system is built in such a way that a small but intensely activated and aroused minority can defeat the will of a larger, less intensely engaged majority. And we political scientists talk about this idea of veto points, places in the legislative process where, again, a small minority can exercise tremendous power and prevent something from moving forward. And given the fact that, for example, in the Senate, you have a tremendous number of Republican senators from small, more rural and agricultural states, they, to a great extent, believe that any kind of gun control is, if you give them an inch, they'll take 5,000 miles. So there's this concern on their part that any kind of regulation will lead to inexorably to the confiscation of guns. Mm-hmm. And a great number of people don't want that. So again, it's a highly charged, very symbolic issue, and the political system is built in such a way that it allows those, that small but intensely motivated minority, to block any kind of action.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our phones. 1-866-780-9100. Steve is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Steve. What's to pitch in from your side?
Yeah, hey, good morning. Just have a question regarding, I think the question I want to ask is the political scientist, and I'm so sorry I forgot your name. I just tuned in. But as far as like the politics of all this going, and I'm on the road a lot, so I don't really hear all the newscasts, but all I hear is that the president is the one that's stoking it all. And I guess I'm not sure because I haven't heard, what is it that he specifically said that was racist or bigoted or white supremacist that was directly correlative to what's going on? Because I guess that's what I've kind of seen is I haven't seen any of the replays of what he said that is specific. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's politically twisted, that it's like people are like using it the other way around against him because they've never wasted an opportunity of a tragedy to go and politicize this.
Okay, Steve, we've got your question. Let's get a response before we come up onto a break from our analysts. Sarah, do you want to tackle that first?
Well, I just use the example of the Texas shooter using the phrase Hispanic invasion of Texas. And invasion was, in fact, a term that Trump used at a speech when talking about illegal immigration. So treating illegal immigration as an invasion, a threat and an invasion. Mm-hmm. So
Dennis, add to that.
Well, it was difficult to make out the questioner's concern there.
He seems to be wanting us, you to cite specific instances of the president's language and actions that are the strongest evidence. Some would say that there is a tie to actions that we've seen, such as in El Paso.
Well, I think to a great extent, the president has functioned. He has governed as president not of the country but of his base. And the idea is among some political scientists and political actors is that there's not much of a center anymore. So you win an election not by trying to compromise and reach across to the other side. You win an election by doubling and tripling and quadrupling down on your base and your base issues. And that's the way thus far the president seems to have governed. I mean, his approval ratings haven't gotten out of the low to mid 40s at all. So the idea is you work on the issues and you push the issues that most activate your particular base, and that's how you win an election.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about this idea of domestic terrorism. The FBI has opened a domestic terrorism investigation into a late July shooting that killed three people. This was in California. Authorities there discovering the gunman had a target list of religious institutions, federal buildings, political organizations. Are we going to be hearing this phrase more often, Sarah, you think? Domestic terrorism, a wider recognition of the threat from within when for many years, we've been focused on threats from outside in terms of terrorism.
I think we will be seeing more of this rhetoric. I was just reading a story today about connecting the international war on terrorism to the domestic war on terrorism and talking about why some of the strategies that we've used abroad might not be effective in the domestic arena. Cutting off financing of groups, using drone attacks or force against groups, if you start imagining doing those kinds of things in the U.S. context, it starts to get politically charged in terms of how domestic groups are being treated. It also is politically charged because who is a domestic terrorist,
right,
and which groups. So Trump in his speech earlier today mentioned white nationalists, but also Antifa as a group that he would consider to be an extremist group. So mm-hmm. It also starts raising the question of who would we label as a domestic terrorist
right.
group.
Dennis, do you see the same problem that we wouldn't be able to define? It would be completely a different narrative, a different subset of who is a domestic terrorist, depending on the party you were in.
Sure, because there's a fragmentation of our information sources. I mean, increasingly people are in their own little information silos or bubbles. And as I think as we've talked about on the program before in the past, when you find someone who has a different position from your own, if you're sort of locked within your own information source, you have only two ways of explaining why someone could have that other point of view. And one answer is to say, well, the person's simply ignorant. But the other answer is to say the person's evil and must be opposed with all your might. So there's less willingness to compromise because there's less and less of a common source of information on the part of people. And there are plenty of folks out there on the internet and elsewhere willing to stoke up those differences.
Okay. We'll be back in just a minute with more of political analysis from Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa on this Politics Wednesday. Still reaching out to you. We'll see how much this carries over into the second half hour before we move on to a couple of other topics. Of course, on the political landscape, far more to talk about than we can in 1 hour. Your thoughts on how, as you observe the reactions of our elected officials, including the president, to the weekend mass shootings. When we move on, we'll talk about the trade war with China. There, an escalation we saw within the last few days. We saw that the president surprising both China and investors by threatening to apply a 10% tariff to $300 billion in goods September 1st. China said it would halt purchases of American farm products and allowed its currency to weaken. We'll get thoughts from Sarah and Dennis on that when we come back. Of course, vitally important to ag economy here in Iowa and the Midwest has its political dimensions. Sarah Mitchell, Dennis Goldford, I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's the deadliest predator in human history. It's killed nearly half of all human beings who have ever lived. It's roughly the size and weight of a grape seed, the mosquito. Tomorrow on this program, I'll talk with historian Tim Weingard. He's just written a new book called The Mosquito, The Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. Tune in tomorrow. Of course, Wednesday, Politics Wednesday. Today with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, the mass shootings and the aftermath in political terms consuming a lot of our discussion this hour. I want to finish up with those and get to talk about a couple of other things here. Of course, the president traveling to Dayton, Ohio today, El Paso, Texas, communities that are grieving after last weekend's mass shootings killing 31 people against a national backdrop. Some blaming the president himself for inflaming racial divisions. The president on Monday responding by condemning white supremacy, calling for the death penalty for mass murderers and domestic terrorists. Let's talk a little bit about the two narratives here and how this feeds into the 2020 race, if we could bring a little closure to this. Dennis, we have the narratives on one side. Republicans saying mental illness, violent video games are to blame. Here's the president's words. We must recognize that the internet has provided a dangerous avenue to radicalize disturbed minds and perform demented acts. We must shine light on the dark recesses of the internet and stop mass murders before they start. Senator Cory Booker, one of our candidates for the Democratic nomination, describing the president as bearing responsibility for this national crisis, citing that Trump's practice of deliberately worsening racial divisions, demonizing immigrants and other minorities, in his words, sowing the seeds of hatred. So we have two completely different worlds here, as we so often do here in politics, Dennis.
You have a situation in which the two sides, in a way, live in different universes. The liberal side, if you will, tends to see guns as the problem, and therefore, if you restrict or eliminate guns, there won't be the problem. The conservative side tends to say, of course, in the classic phrase, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Now, at the same time, of course, you have a situation in which people with guns kill people a lot more efficiently than people without guns. You have mental illness in other countries, but you don't have the kind of gun homicide statistics you have in this country. But it's a highly charged issue. It's more than just a fight over what the speed limit should be. It's very much of a cultural issue. Democrats claim they don't want to eliminate guns used for hunting. Many of them don't like hunting as a sport. Others will say that's fine. But guns, of course, are more of an everyday kind of device in small town and rural areas. And so they see questions about or attacks on guns and gun ownership as an attack on their very way of life. And they resent that tremendously. And this, of course, has been divided since the Democrats, although historically had more of a rural base, they're more the coastal and urban party, and Republicans now are the more the central part of the country, Midwest and South, and the rural party. And so this conflict has taken on these partisan dimensions.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about we have groups that are really vocal on each side, Sarah. Isn't there a broad consensus in this country? I'm thinking of perhaps increasing background checks, that you could go to polling and see that background checks, an increase in enforcing existing gun laws, and perhaps placing some more background checks would be something that the majority of Americans would be in favor of?
I think that's true. That survey data show the majority of Americans are in favor of background checks. But as we discussed earlier, the Congress basically is unwilling to act fully on, you know, so the House passed a bill that would increase background checks when individuals sell guns to other individuals, for example, but mm-hmm. the Senate has been unwilling to take up that, you know, to pass that bill or to even assign it to committee. So I think what will happen with the presidential race is that the candidates will be able to stake out things that they can do via executive action. So for example, President Obama passed an executive order that said that if you were a disability, if you were designated as a disability recipient through the Social Security Administration, then you could be placed on a list for automatic background check. The Trump administration has rolled back this approach. Here's an example where, you know, if you think mental health is at the core of these issues, then you can take executive action that tries to address those problems. We also saw Senator Harris today tweeting, for example, that she would revoke licenses of gun manufacturers who break laws. She would require anyone who sells more than 5 guns a year to do background checks, and she would try to ban importation of AR-15 style assault weapons. And so I think what we'll be seeing from a lot of the candidates, certainly we've seen O'Rourke and Castro also coming out with very specific responses to these mass shootings. So I think what we'll see is the candidates will probably take positions in terms of what they can do as executives, because if Congress is unwilling to act, then the president will be able to take action that Congress is basically unwilling to do.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to a couple of other items. This Politics Wednesday, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University with us, if you've just joined us, a reminder there. Let's talk about the trade war with China. It's far from clear whether The president will win a deal before American voters head to the polls next November. Last week, the president surprising, evidently, China and also investors by threatening to apply a 10% tariff on $300 billion of goods coming September 1st, then swiftly retaliated by labeling the country a currency manipulator also on Monday. This came after China said it would halt purchases of American farm products and allow its currency to weaken. Let's listen to Larry Kudlow. Larry Kudlow is director of the National Economic Council, chief advisor to the president. He joined CNBC's Squawk on the Street to discuss the trade tensions that led to the sell-off we saw on Monday. We're seeing a lot of volatility today as well, and what he's seeing in the economy. Larry Kudlow.
I want to emphasize this morning as much as I can, as difficult as things may be, and I know the markets are a bit volatile, but the reality is we would like to negotiate. We're planning for the Chinese team to come here in September. Things could change with respect to the tariffs. The president has said, you know, if you make good deal or good progress on a deal, maybe he'll be flexible on the tariffs. On the other hand, if there's no progress on the deal, then the tariffs might get worse, but he's open to it. That's really the key point. There was a lot of disappointment last May, a couple of months ago, when it seemed like the Chinese were pulling back. It's ebbed and flowed. That's all I want to say on that point. And again, the issue is, I believe the president is still very much open to the negotiations.
Larry Kudlow, a chief advisor to the president, speaking on Monday, a day when the stock market's worst day of 2019 happened, the S&P declining by 3%. So let's go to where it hits us here in the Midwest and have you both comment on this. China is halting new purchases of U.S. soybeans, other ag products, U.S. farm exports to China dropping by over $9 billion in 2018. Sarah, your thoughts on this? High-stakes trade war that the president is involved in.
Well, I think what China has done in terms of saying that they will stop buying U.S. agricultural products is really significant because we've already seen a decline. This year alone, we've seen hog exports to China down 4%. We've seen soybean exports down 13%. And China buys 60% of all U.S. soybeans. So we're talking about the largest buyer of U.S. soybeans by a large margin. So even if U.S. farmers try to get alternate markets and alternate buyers, which is what they're doing, it takes time, right, for those market adjustments. And, you know, analyses of the government bailouts basically to farmers shows that there's a lot of inequality in how those bailouts are working. So for farmers that are making less than $100,000 a year, they're only getting something like $1,200 in bailout. So, clearly you have, if you're a soybean farmer in Iowa, right, you don't have buyers for your goods. If you switch your production to corn or other products, that's going to affect the prices of those goods. And so, the whole thing, I think, if China follows through and stops buying U.S. ag products, we're going to have a serious problem in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And a reminder that, as you mentioned, the White House already earmarking some $28 billion in financial assistance for farmers whose sales to China have been crippled or blocked. This week, the president suggesting that aid could be extended. Dennis Goldford, your thoughts.
Well, this is an example. This is where Mr. Trump and his policy with regard to tariffs and trade tears up Republican orthodoxy, because, of course, Republican orthodoxy was to support free markets and just let normal market forces determine the level of trade and so forth. And Mr. Trump believes that the U.S. is systematically disadvantaged in trade. I mean, there's no question about the intellectual property issues with the Chinese taking American intellectual property. But I think that, Mr. Trump keeps saying that the Chinese pay the tariffs, but that's not the case. The Chinese export goods to the United States. Those in the United States who import these goods pay the tariffs. Now, they can eat that extra cost themselves, or they can pass that on to consumers by raising those prices. or if the Chinese, at least on my understanding, if they, as we've seen, weaken their currency, so a dollar buys twice as much or 50% as much of Chinese currency as it used to, in that sense, the prices don't go as up as much for Americans, and the Chinese, in that sense, bear the brunt of that economic impact. But so far, Mr. Trump's support in rural and small-town areas is holding. A lot of them, folks in those areas, are willing to give him still the benefit of the doubt, but it is starting to hurt, as with the figures that you all have mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, on that point that Dennis just mentioned, how vulnerable do you think this president is when it comes to support among the ag community? I mean, here in Iowa and in broadly speaking in the Midwest, this is his red base, right?
So one of my former students, Olga Cheech, who's a professor at Iowa State University, did an analysis of Democratic votes in the last midterm election. And what she and her co-authors show is that as soybean prices were falling, Democratic votes went up in those districts. And so they show that there seems to be in these rural states a direct electoral connection between what's happening in the ag market and whether people are voting Democratic or Republican.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're finished up on that. Let's talk a little bit about the 4th District race, which got even more interesting this week. The Democrat, he came close to defeating Republican, longtime Republican Congressman Steve King in Iowa's 4th Congressional District in 2018, has announced he's running for office again. J.D. Scholten made the announcement this week, but before Scholten can run against King, King is a 9-term congressman. He is facing now a primary challenge from many Republican challengers, Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor, former Irwin Mayor Brett Richards, also State Senator Randy Feenstra of Hall. It was in 2018 that Scholten won 6 counties in that district, including those with the largest population. So this is a man who lost to King by just 3 points last year in 2018. This is a district that, Donald Trump, Dennis won by 20-some points. So this was a very close call for Steve King. I want to ask you how you size it up, Dennis. How vulnerable is Steve King, especially since it was this year, earlier, that he was stripped of committee assignments by his own party in the House, right?
Yes. There are a couple of things. Number one, there are Republicans in the 4th District who don't have any problem with the sorts of things that Congressman King says. And we have to say that it's one of the, outside the South at least, it is one of the most Republican districts in the country. So the question for Mr. Scholten, again, making another chance, taking another shot at winning that race, if in fact King is not the Republican nominee, if, say, Feenstra is, who seems to be the establishment Republican candidate to replace King, if Feenstra is the nominee, it's hard to see how Scholten will win that, because a lot of Scholten's vote was just an anti-King vote last time around. If it is Steve King, then again, there's the question of whether Republicans in that 3rd district, again, who are the overwhelming majority, have decided that they've had enough of Mr. King and are willing to turn it over to someone like Scholten.
Mm-hmm. Before comment from you, Sarah, I'd like to play something from J.D. Scholten's campaign website. This is a really interesting video, high production value and emotional appeal, with beautiful images of farmland, cattle farmers at work, family praying at the dinner, faces of the old, the young. And this is all narrated by Kevin Costner of Field of Dreams fame. Let's listen to this campaign video on J.D. Scholten's website.
It is here, among the rolling hills, along the endless road, in the wind. It's in the dirt and the mud and the soil, in our calloused hands, their gentle touch.
Bless us, O Lord, and
the sense of who we are. It is here in the fields and in the sea, amongst the cattle, the machine, in our towns and our homes, our blessings and our troubles, and the elders who know too much, and our children who know too little. It is here, our virtues, passed down through the seasons, sowed into earth from long ago, grown and nurtured and tended to. It is here, rooted within us, within him.
Final images there, a close-up of J.D. Shulton squatting in a farm field, fingering some dirt. Kevin Costner there narrating that. Sarah Mitchell, comment on that ad, the approach. We have no attack on Steve King. We have a purely emotional, value-driven appeal here, right? What's going on?
I think this is really smart by Shulton. He's using a populist message, and he's coming at it from a couple of perspectives. So one relates to the farm issues that we just discussed. So there's a lot of images in the ad that show farmers, right, and a lot of rural setting. If you look at some of his statements, he's talking about how farmers are being hurt by lack of access to credit by banks, for example. Iowa farmers have more debt total than California farmers, just to give you the magnitude of how much financing Iowa farmers need. Mm. He's also talking about how these large seed companies and large corporations are hurting small farmers in Iowa. So I think, again, that's another populist message. He mentions the fact that when he goes out to these towns in the district, that people, when he goes to a Casey's, he finds a can where people are asking for donations to help pay for their health care, their health costs. And he's using his support for Medicare for All, relating it back to this populist message where, you know, people in his district, right, don't have, you know, they don't have the economic situation they want. They don't have the government support that they need for things like healthcare or getting a loan from their bank.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, your thoughts? I don't know if you had a chance to look at the video in addition to hearing the audio there.
No, I saw the video, and I think everybody should take a look at that. That is a tremendous ad. The production values, but the overall tone, of course, is reverential. It's tremendous respect for people in rural and small town areas. And the Trump victory was the victory or the revenge of rural and small town area against big city urban America. And the question is whether that will work for J.D. Shulton or not, because, again, he's got to labor under the fact that Hillary Clinton allegedly referred to people represented by the video as deplorables, Trump supporters and people like that. And it's an attempt, again, to show that at least one Democratic candidate has this tremendous respect for rural and small-town America. But that's been a diminishing asset for Democrats for quite a long time, and Shulton and other Democrats have an uphill battle in reestablishing that sense of trust.
Mm-hmm. Considering that the Republicans in Congress have knocked Steve King down a few notches, taking away committee assignments, can we, Dennis, assume that they are rooting for one of Steve King's primary opponents?
Well, for at least some Republicans, Representative King is an embarrassment, which is why they've done those things. But sure, they'd be hoping for somebody else to be able to win that nomination. But of course, three candidates fragment the field somewhat. And if it goes to a convention, if nobody wins 35% in that particular primary, it could well be Congressman King again, which ironically would help J.D. Shulton in his challenge.
Okay, we'll watch that fourth congressional district, as we have many months to go before that primary is decided, let alone for the general election. But Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University, Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Sarah and Dennis, thank you so much for offering your observations this hour and your analysis.
You bet.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the program, I'll talk with the author of The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. Tim Weingart, a professor of history and political science, has written a new book, How the Mosquito Has Changed Human History. A fascinating read. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for that program. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Shirley Wong, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.